Today on PES Exchange, the economics of science fiction worlds. Welcome to PES Exchange, the forum where we discuss everything related to the historical experience of markets and their philosophical foundations. Today we will be joined by Marco Yama. He's an associate professor of economics at George Mason University and a senior scholar at the Mercatus Center. He's interested in how historical institutions function and in the relationship between culture and economic performance. His work has been published in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, the Journal of Economic Literature, the Economic Journal, and many other scholarly journals. Welcome back, Mark.
Great. Thanks for having me, Fernando. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Whether it's envisioning space travel, artificial intelligence, genetic engineering, or delving into the implications of quantum mechanics, science fiction extrapolates from current scientific knowledge to construct alternative realities. However, while scientific accuracy is important, the essence of compelling sci-fi lies in the constraints it imposes on its characters and their interactions within these speculative settings. What truly captivates audiences are the social questions it raises, the portrayal of the diverse societies, cultures, and the interpersonal dynamics within these fictional worlds. Themes encompassing human behavior, societal frameworks, power dynamics, and the consequences of technological advancement on individuals and communities. Today, Mark will delve into how social science shapes sci-fi narratives and the insights we can derive from them. So, Mark, it is clear that fictional narratives, including those within the realm of science fiction, often draw inspiration from historical events. However, what about the reverse? How can fictional narratives impact social development? For example, Paul Krugman, the economist, famously attributed his decision to pursue economics to his fascination with his Isaac Asimov's Foundation series and the concept of psychohistory. He found parallels between psychohistory and economics, leading him to delve into the latter. Considering this, to what extent do you believe fictional narratives can shape specific trends in economic and social development?
I think it's a fascinating question. I'm familiar with Paul Krugman's discussions of the Foundation trilogy. So the idea of, what I would say, just in a very basic sense, is that a lot of science fiction, and particularly Asimov, elevates the role of the scientist, so elevates the role of potentially the economist or the social scientist, raises their status relative to their status in previous types of societies or previous periods of history. So that's one way in which science fiction has had an effect on our societies, raising the status of science, raising the interest in science. I think the huge popularity of sci-fi post-World War II could have generated a lot more potential scientists, and even through the channel Paul Krugman mentions, economists, potentially.
You recently published something about Dune. I really want to focus on that. So when we look at Dune properly, among the numerous themes explored in the novel, I think two stand out prominently, at least in my view. The concept of the messiah figure and the significance of spies as the main commodity. Let's just first discuss the notion of relying on political leaders as messiahs to solve societal issues. So the author of Dune, Frank Herbert, he famously remarked that he considered Nixon to be the best president of the United States, mostly because Nixon's presidency exemplified why charismatic political leaders should be viewed with skepticism. Throughout the narrative of Paul Atreides, the main protagonist of Dune, his ascent and subsequent downfall, what insights can we glean from this cautionary tale?
Yeah, so it's a great question, and this gets to the heart of what I discuss in my blog post and my piece. So people who haven't read the books, who often maybe have seen both films now, but they're often somewhat puzzled by this because the framing you'll get maybe in some kind of common kind of takes on this is Paul quote-unquote a goodie, or is he quote-unquote, a baddie? And what I briefly say in my piece is he's neither. He's a tragic figure, tragic in the tradition of kind of Greek tragedy or Shakespearean tragedy. So he's not meant to be purely good or purely evil. He embodies these very human traits, despite being, you know, superhuman in terms of his abilities. But he's a tragic figure because he can't escape the dilemma of power, basically. So he can't escape his destiny, and his destiny has this tragic quality because, as is heralded at the end of June part two of the movie, you know, so foreshadowed in part one, and it's foreshadowed in the novels, and then brought to fruition in Frank Herbert's sequel book, June Messiah. The fate of Paul is to lead basically a global jihad, which is going to conquer the galaxy at the cost of billions of lives. But the regime he's going to reconstitute in place of the previous empire is going to be every bit or even more oppressive. It's going to be a theocracy. And so in some sense, he's supposed to be freeing the Fremen, and he does free them. He frees them from the oppression of the Harkonnens, who are kind of represent kind of forces of kind of autocratic, despotic evil in both the films and the books. So he frees the Fremen, but he doesn't really free them because his new regime is actually quite totalitarian, and perhaps more deeply totalitarian than its precursor regimes. So you're asking me, I guess, also about like why unpick this a little bit more. So why does Herbert want to tell this story? So I'm not an expert. I should, as a caveat on Frank Herbert, I have read his biography by his son Brian Herbert, and the impression you get there is he's what you would call like an old school kind of Republican, in the sense that he's suspicious of central government, suspicious of federal government, but he's believing in kind of autonomous individualism, but he's not extreme conservative in any sense, but he has he's kind of skeptical of government, small L libertarian, let's say, sympathies, which is interesting given how he also has a lot of concerns about the environment and man's damage to the environment, which make him attractive to kind of environmentalists and hippies in the 70s. But he has these kind of 1950s small L libertarian sentiments. And so he didn't like Kennedy. He was wary of Kennedy because too many hopes were placed on Kennedy. People kind of took all their problems and then thought that Kennedy would be able to solve them. And that desire for a political messiah he sees as very dangerous. And so the Dune novels are kind of meant to raise up our hopes, to attach our hopes to this potential, this hero who is heroic. The Paul Atreides is brave, he's wise, he's kind of a strategic genius, he's a mentat, but he also has these other insights from drinking the water of life. So he has all these amazing abilities, but even so, the outcome, no matter how able he is, his ability to shape kind of the fate of human society is actually limited.
The other pivotal theme in the Dune series, basically what it gives the series the name, it revolves around the planet Arrakis, which serves as the exclusive source of this highly valued commodity, which is called the spice. And while the spice possesses various uses, its most significant role lies in facilitating faster than light travel, which I think is a lovely theme. So the narrative aspect is particularly intriguing as it challenges the commonplace assumptions of instant communication that we nowadays have come to rely. In a universe where the speed of light imposes constraints, communication and transportation become formidable obstacles akin to the challenges faced in earlier centuries of human history. So the existence of a substance like spice, capable of circumnavigating such limitations, carries profound implications, especially given its monopoly on a single planet. And while many have drawn parallels between spice and oil in the context of the Middle Eastern politics in Frank Herbert's time, spice, I think, transcends oil significance in the narrative. Do you believe that the presence of spice adequately explains the settings in Dune?
So this is an important theme. I think, you know, both of us have read John Nye, my colleague at George Mason. He wrote a blog post about this as well. So, and his point, which I think is well taken, is actually, yeah, it's more important than oil because oil has substitutes. Here, there's no substitutes for spice. in terms of generating, being able to make faster than light travel possible. And so, moreover, faster than light travel should have more dramatic implications than it really does in the Dune universe, actually, because it's akin to time travel, right? You can transport things faster than light can move to them. So it's almost like you're moving faster than time. So you should have the ability to cover arbitrage for price markets, or like sell things at high prices, buy at low prices. So some sense, the economics of spice are probably, as you say, understated by the analogy of oil, and probably underexplored in the Dune universe. I think that's fair. And I should say, as a background kind of for this discussion, I'm a sci-fi fan, but I'm not a sci-fi expert. I'm not that versed on all aspects, so particularly of hard science fiction. But what draws me to Dune is a little bit like a heroic fantasy novel, but transposed to a future world where the science is different, as opposed to a purely hard sci-fi novel, which is just exploring the implications of the new technologies in a fictional world. And I've read Dune, the original novel, several times, and I've read the sequels. Some of the sequels I've read more than once, but I'm by no means an expert at all. And I also don't think Frank Herbert necessarily is a. He's not in my. He wrote an amazing book, and so I'm very thankful for him. He created an amazing universe, but I also don't think he's necessarily the best writer or an amazing writer at all times. So I don't think I don't think that his words are kind of sacrosanct. So I feel that he does underexplore things. There can be kind of mistakes in this universe. And, there are definitely issues with some of the later novels, particularly with, dialogue and those types of issues. So I think what Dune does and what good science fiction does is it provides us with a sandbox, an intellectual sandbox where we can play around with different ideas. And actually, it's good, almost, it's fine if we can depart from the original author sometimes without that being, a crime.
No, yeah, I totally agree with that. But for example, myself, I think I draw myself more towards science fiction, generally speaking, even if it's not hard science fiction, because at the end of the day, it still asks questions about basically how do we see ourselves in the future. Unlike, for example, traditional fantasy, let's say Lord of the Rings. In Lord of the Rings, you have several races, orcs, elves, and we are not asked to think hard about how these races socially organize them. It's just that we are taking for granted that they are the way they are. Here we are really questioning kind of why do humans in the future act the way I do. So at the end of the day, it's still kind of a social question. And as you said, it's kind of we are at the end of the day, modeling future phenomena through a sandbox and putting different constraints than the one that we have. Another, and connected with this, and I think an underlying thing within Dune is basically perhaps the absence of significant technological progress. So this is attributed in the setting of Dune to this historical event where artificial intelligence rebelled against humanity, leaving a lasting aversion to technological advancements among the universe inhabitants. This reluctance towards technological innovation is pervasive across all actors, means economically and technologically stagnant. And the stagnation raises concerns analogous to our current world, where debates resolve around whether we are experiencing stagnation due to low productivity growth and a lack of major technological breakthroughs. Do you believe that a stagnant economy and the technological landscape tend to foster less tolerant, less democratic, and less free political societies?
Yeah, so with several questions there. A short answer is yes. What I would say is in the Dune narrative, you get the sense, and I'm not like, as I said, like totally on every aspect of, say, the Balerian Jihad, which is this backstory event which you mentioned, where the intelligent machines kind of rose against humanity, and then they had to be destroyed, basically. And so that's where you have, the Dune timeline departs from our timeline in many respects. That's one of the key junctures with this banning of artificial intelligence. So they don't have computers. And so you can think about they've made choices in this timeline basically to retard technological progress in the means of ensuring the survival of humanity, which is actually a reoccurring theme in review novels, where there's some sort of trade-off between the rate of technological progress and like whether or not humanity will survive. And so that's the first kind of thought I have in response. Secondly, I think economic history shows, even recent economic history shows, that technology is not linear. Technological progress is not linear. It comes in fits and starts because there are synergies, externalities, and kind of interlinkages amongst sectors that you can get. You can run into a bottleneck, and growth can be quite slow, and then suddenly something might break that bottleneck. So if you think about in the modern economic context, about 15 years ago, Tyler Cowen wrote a book called The Great Stagnation, and Robert Gordon wrote a book around 2015 talking about like this relative stagnation of US economy in terms of its technological productivity after 1970 relative to the period in the late 19th century through to the middle of the 20th century. So Gordon's point was the technologies which made the modern world rich were kind of one-off technologies. And we haven't ever had equally seismic or transformative technologies since. And Cowen was saying, look, the IT revolution has only had so much of an impact on the economy, and that's why we've had this great stagnation. But Cowen's position there was to say that actually that doesn't mean we're going to keep stagnating. And actually, it could be that a bunch of big breakthroughs around the corner and they're coming up, and maybe they've already started. Whereas Gordon was more pessimistic. And I think Tyler's view is that AI is one of those breakthroughs. And so AI now is something where we've seen tremendous breakthroughs in the last kind of, say, 5 years or 3 years. But that raises the question, which, you know, science fiction writers have been thinking about since Philip K. Dick, if not before, which is that, like, this technology could be detrimental to humanity. So you could have, like, you know, intelligent, artificial intelligence, destroy humans, this so-called of Skynet scenario from the Terminator movies. And in the Dune universe, they've basically obviously made societal choices to prevent technology from destroying humanity. And the result has been some level of technological stagnation, although they've innovated in terms of their bioengineering and so on, it seems like. Their biological technology seems to have advanced, but they haven't moved at all further in terms of computing. Like, computers are bad. They have mentats instead, human computers. People are trained and maybe genetically engineered from birth, you know, before being born, so that they can compute kind of complicated probabilities or, you know, plot kind of, you know, trajectories of flight paths or strategize. So all of this is to say is that technological change is not linear. Stagnation is possible. We see this historically. And in the Dune universe, it seems to be to ensure the survival of humanity, they've deliberately turned off certain areas of technological development. And if you see their society as well, it's also kind of designed in some sense. It reminds us more. This is to get to your final point. It reminds us more of a medieval world. It's, you know, quasi-feudal in many respects. But it relies on what Noel Johnson and I in our book, Execution and Toleration, call identity rules. So, you know, like, people are kind of brought up from birth in their particular niche. So the I can't pronounce this word, but we have this concept called the Farfalluches, I think. Farfalluches is how you pronounce it. In June, where like, you're basically, it's just like a, you know, it's like the medieval world. You do what your father has done. If you're born a soldier, you're a soldier. If you're born a trader, you're a trader. It's some kind of very static hierarchical ordering of society. And the idea is this is kind of a way of keeping, I guess, stability.
At the outset of the series and within the setting of the movie, I would say that there are three primary institutions that emerge as central pillars of human society, and you let me know if you agree or disagree with the assessment that I will do. But the first one is, of course, the Empire and the Landsrat, which comprise various conflicting houses, with divergent interests, and they symbolize, of course, the political authority. And mostly of what we see in the movies basically surround the conflicts there. The second institution is the Bene Gesserit, which is this female organization endowed with supernatural abilities and engaged in eugenic programs to manipulate outcomes in their favor. And they more or less represent a religious authority. And the third one is the Space Guild, which regulates trade and communication routes through spice consumption, and it embodies economic authority. And there are many, of course, aspects to discuss about it, but I'm particularly intrigued by the portrayal of the Space Guild, which appears to be the least elucidated of the three institutions, both in the movies and in the Herbert's original work. So this is despite being them pivotal to the functioning of the universe. So the Space Guild receives comparatively less development in terms of storytelling. It is notable that in history, so in the real world, medieval merchant guilds were often similarly perceived as mere backdrops on a grander stage, yet they wielded significant influence. Do you concur with this assessment? Do you believe in general that the Space Guild should have been depicted as possessing more power than what is portrayed in the novels and the movies?
Yeah, so particularly in the movies, they get short shift. So there is, we live in that, right? So famous, I think in the David Lynch film in the 80s, which is in many respects quite a bad film, but it's quite fun as well. They have a very good visual representation of the Space Guild guys, and they basically live in vats, and they've like evolved, I guess, by too much spice consumption, because they're folding space. You've almost evolved into these barely human creatures with fins, and they float around, and they become a bit more important, I think, in Dune Messiah, the second book in the series, because there's a Space Guild guy who conspires against Paul Atreides. But yeah, in the movie, in Gene Part 2, we definitely get undersold. And in general, they don't really have a dramatic role in the books. And so your point, I think, is right. So what you're saying is, in some sense, if these guys are the guys who really can only, the only people who could do space travel, any people who could do fast online travel, they should be, in some sense, the most important group within this kind of political configuration that we observe. And they are important. And they lend their support to House Corino, and then they have to submit to Paul Atreides in the books, but they don't have any dynamic role. Like, we don't hear they agree to transport both the House Atreides to Arrakis, and then they're also paid off, right, by the Harkonnens to transport this army of Harkonnens and Sardaukar to ambush the Atreides. So they're there, but they're in the background. You could say that's a bit like the role that merchant guilds sometimes could have played, or international banks may have played in medieval history. So very, very important, but they're not like the Black Prince. They're not the celebrities. They're not Henry V at Agincourt, right? It's always going to be the political leaders, the Paul Atreides, will get the attention. But there could be these mysterious forces in the background. I'm slightly reminded of the banks in Game of Thrones. I think it's called the Iron Bank in Game of Thrones. So in the Game of Thrones novels, there's also these banking houses. And I think people say that George R. R. Martin may have been the first fantasy writer to introduce banks basically to a fantasy setting. And they're important actually because they're funding the different houses in Game of Thrones. But obviously the TV show forgets all about this because it becomes kind of stupid. But the books also don't really, they kind of forget about it for long periods of time. But we're told the Iron Bank of Braavos is very important. But then sometimes it's forgotten about. And so maybe you can make the same criticism here of the Spicy Guild and Gene, but they do play, I think, a central role. But they're always in the background. And, if Frank Herbert's universe was one where, like, other writers could contribute beyond just his son, then maybe we would get, stories from a perspective of the Space Guild, and maybe that would be good. But as it is, we don't have that in the world Herbert created.
So now let's talk a little bit about the dynamics within the Empire and among the rival houses. Why would the Empire or the Emperor ever yield control of the spice to a competing house? wouldn't it be more advantageous to monopolize it for oneself? Indeed, this is precisely the strategy adopted by Atreides later on in the rest of the novels. And this is how Paul's son attains complete control. Does this make sense?
Yeah, maybe you'll have to answer this one for me, because I agree with you. I mean, I agree with what you're suggesting, which is that there's seemingly an inconsistency between the underlying political technologies and the actual patterns of power we observe. And so, as we've mentioned already, the description of the houses is like a variant of European feudalism. Not an exact analogy, but it's a variant of European feudalism. There are independent houses, very military forces, very planetary governments. They have these, their soldiers are very, very loyal to their house. So, the Atreides guards will die for the Atreides. The Sardaukar will die for the emperor. They're not going to fight directly for the emperor. Like, House Atreides soldiers will obey House Atreides, not the emperor. So it's a feudal world. There's decentralized violence, decentralized control of violence, no monopoly of violence. And we think of this world in medieval Europe as emerging because the economies of early medieval Europe were actually so poor. People were mostly at subsistence. There wasn't a big surplus. So we think that the early medieval states just didn't find it worthwhile to tax. There wasn't a money economy to easily tax. So they didn't find it worthwhile to maintain the type of political organization that, say, Romans or Persians had maintained, where you tax the surplus from the farmers and you use it to kind of hire a professional army. Rather, they just elicited kind of bargains from local lords saying, if I need you, you'll come to my aid and bring with you your retinue of men. And this retinue of men were just loyal to them at a very local level. And so we think of the technology of early Middle Ages giving rise to the political arrangements of feudalism. But if we look at the world of Dune, it seems like it should be the opposite, which is, I think, what you're getting at. It seems more like you have a monopoly, potentially a monopoly, of the one most valuable commodity in the universe, one commodity which makes interstellar leather travel possible, and also interstellar trade possible. And so therefore, if you control this monopoly, you should rule the empire, because you should have so many resources that you could basically raise a big enough military force to crush your rivals. And so it makes us think that the world of Dune should be an absolute monarchy, not a feudal kind of system. And that's what it becomes under Paul Atreides. And so, I don't want to necessarily say that Frank Herbert's like totally stupid here or making mistakes, but I think it's a bit of an incongruity, which maybe, it needs a little bit more fine-tuning he leaves a lot of things unspecified, of course.
So we can say that this is also a period of instability and the equilibrium is basically Atreides as the monarchy.
Exactly, yeah. So we don't know enough of a backstory, at least based just on the canonical Herbert Dune novels, not the prequels by his son. We don't have enough of a backstory to know for sure. It could be out of an out of equilibrium situation. So I the Harkonnens happen to be having this monopoly, but maybe the Harkonnens are just so unpopular amongst, they don't have the ability yet to use that spice wealth. Well, they're not extracting enough of it. They're losing too much spice to the Fremen. And they're not yet in a position to create a monopoly of force across the galaxy based on spice wealth. But maybe in time they could have. And that's what Paul basically is able to do. Paul, by being a very good political entrepreneur, is moving us to the equilibrium very quickly, quicker than it would otherwise move. But maybe that was always the underlying equilibrium.
In the series of novels, I think there is only one organization that endures all the events, and those are the Bene Gesserit. The Lanzrat, the empire collapses in the wake of Paul's jihad, and later the empire itself collapses with the death of Paul's son. The Space Guild also fades into obscurity when mention occurs that this spy is kind of not irrelevant, but at least not as necessary as it used to be. But the Bene Gesserit, as the religious authority, persists. Why do you think this is the case?
Yeah, so I don't have a great answer to this question. It's well known that Frank Herbert chose the name Bene Gesserit to rhyme with Jesuit. Like, it's meant to be a play on words in some sense. And so he thinks religion is a very core kind of principle in human societies. And so, the kind of weird religions they have in the Dune world are meant to be kind of descendants of religions we would recognize. So he's always talking about, like, the Orange Catholic Bible. He talks about Zen Sunni Buddhism. He takes Buddhism and Islamic ideas and merges them. And the Orange Catholic Bible is also meant to be a syncretic idea, because the orange is supposed to be like the color of the Protestant Orange Order. But then it's the Orange Catholic Bible. So he thinks religious. And the other group, which is in the final book, which is a very odd touch, but it's also very interesting. The only group which survives intact in his novels are the Jews, actually. So in Chapter House Dune, the final novel, they're Jews, and they're basically the same as they practice the same Judaism that we do, that we have, that exists today. So that's another odd touch, or interesting touch, you'd say. But the Bene Gesserit are very mysterious. I don't quite know. They're also symbolizing femininity, some of the power of women. So there's a lot of ideas he packs into them, which are actually, to most people's ordinary reading, incongruent, right? So they're both basically, they practice eugenics. Their name sounds like the Jesuits. They're all women. There are no men allowed. And their aims are kind of never fully, you know, like they have these esoteric kind of aims, like the Kwisatz Haderach and so on. But you never really understand what their goal is. Well, you understand it in its own terms, but not in terms outside of a novel. At least I don't fully understand what their goal is. But the key thread, obviously, linking together all of the novels, because the novels span several thousand years, I think.
Just kind of tying on of this together. In Dune, basically, there exists this concept idea of what Herbert calls the golden path, more or less that humanity must adhere to in order to ensure its survival. And the prescient figures in the novel, particularly, of course, Paul Atreides and his descendants, operate under the belief that they must recreate the necessary conditions for humanity to follow this path. In your discussion, in your text, you draw parallels with the concept of the narrow corridor proposed by Acemoglu and co-authors, which more or less argues that there is a delicate balance between freedom and state coercion, more or less. Veer too much towards one extreme, and chaos ensues. Veer too much towards the other, and despotism reigns. Would you like to further explore this idea? Because I'm not entirely honestly convinced. From my perspective, the notion of the golden path, at least within the novels, appears to be more like a chimeric idea, a way to fool oneself. So, for example, prescience does not negate free will. It is not synonymous with predetermination. And I think this distinction is what sets Paul apart and his tragedy, his story becomes a tragedy. And it's what sets him apart from his son and the other characters. So my argument then would be that the golden path, as depicted in the novels at least, is less about achieving an optimal balance between state authority and civil society, and more about a political figure preemptively attempting to shape a desired outcome.
Okay, so there's a lot there to unpack, and I'm going to agree with you on one of those, that last point for sure. So I think the Dune novels are doing, they're working at different levels, and they're saying different things at different levels. So from a point of view of the first three novels, I actually like what you're saying. I think you're right. The prescience is a bit of a trap, right, for Paul Atreides. And also, I think for Leto the third, for his son Leto the third, these are prescience doesn't negate free will, and he becomes trapped by his vision. So he sees all these possibilities, and he thinks he's choosing the best one by trying to avoid the two worst extremes. But the path he ends up realizing is also in many respects bad, and then he then tries to comfort himself by saying, you know, I had no choice in some sense. Well, I didn't have a choice. The alternatives were worse. but we don't actually know that. I actually thought the movies explore this or suggest this in a way. I don't know if this was intended by the director. I assume it was. The movies suggest this, that a better path is possible, and he's not choosing it, or he's not choosing it. So again, this is going back to the original Dune trilogy as being a tragedy, and that's why the original Dune trilogy are more interesting books, because they're a personal tragedy. The later books are more just about the universe and the world. But to go back to the original books as a tragedy, Paul's prescience doesn't seem to ensure he's choosing the best options always. And in the movies, you see Janice, his rival, the guy he kills. And in the books, in reality, what actually happens, he has to kill him to make himself one of the Fremen, to show that he's one of them, and to then go on this path towards becoming Muad'Dib and becoming their leader and their messiah. In the movies, you see these flashbacks where actually Janice is his friend and is like training him in the ways of the desert, suggesting actually there was a more peaceable route. And he, in some sense, he didn't choose that one, and maybe that one would have been better. So Paul's prescience may not be complete. He may only have the illusion that he's fully prescient. So he sees many features, but who's to say he's seeing all the features? And so when he thinks he's choosing the best features, he may well not be. And so maybe in some sense, you know, this would be consistent with my reading of this as a tragedy. It's an interpretation. Who knows if it's close to Herbert's. It's an interpretation where Paul is really a fully tragic figure precisely because this prescience and this idea of a golden path and the ability to pick the ideal feature is a trap, as you're saying. And Lieto the Third is even more so because he becomes a sandworm, basically. And He hoards all the spice, and he basically reverts humanity back to like subsistence poverty. And he thinks this is the only way to basically prevent humanity's destruction. That's what the golden path is for him. And you're saying that maybe that, you know, could be a delusional thing that would-be despotic leaders can tell themselves to justify what they're doing, the choices they're making. So whereas what I was talking about with Vassimoglu and Robertson idea of a narrow corridor is quite different, you're saying, which is, you know, it's about how to get to a more flourishing free society. What I would say is I think that the idea of a path and it being winding and narrow is very much in keeping with Herbert's themes, not just with the golden path, but throughout the book. So recall I was saying that AI technology, computers are banned to ensure humanity's survival. So all the time, Herbert's thinking about basically a world where you're trading off freedom and prosperity on the one hand with like basically humanity's survival on the other hand. So the idea being that there's some kind of narrow path you have to weave between in order that humanity doesn't destroy itself. Whilst also allowing this expansion of humans across the galaxy. And that idea of a path basically got me seeing these parallels. But I agree that the Acemoglu Robinson path is kind of a liberal path, whereas the paths you see in Herbert's novels are all illiberal. But I think there's a, you know, if you think about this way of thinking about these trade-offs and this idea of a phase diagram with a narrow path, and the big basins of attraction, like despotism or anarchy, that's consistent with how Herbert thinks about kind of human history, and it's different to how, say, Francis Fukuyama, at least in the end of history, thinks about it, or how modernization theorists think about it. It's a far more kind of, I don't know, cautious or pessimistic vision. And I saw some analogies there, but I fully agree with you that it's not probably exactly what Herbert had in mind. And this golden path idea reoccurs in different ways across the different novels. I was never fully satisfied with it in the novels. Like many people, I my favorite novel is Dune. And then I also like Dune Messiah and Children of Dune a lot. The God Emperor of Dune is a super weird novel, which is just kind of crazy and weird, but very interesting. But I think it's, you know, there's something in there which is. But then I was kind of disappointed by the final novels in the series.
So yeah, I agree with you all on that. I found Code Emperor of Dune seems weird in several ways, in tying all the novels together, because I think, honestly, for me, it's kind of the least realistic in a social science way, at least in the way in which Herbert tries to portray it. Just for example, just to give a little bit of context of what I'm talking about here, in the later novellas, the God Emperor of Dune, which is Paul's son, Leto II, becomes this despotic emperor and justifies his actions by claiming to teach humanity a lesson about the importance of freedom, or lack thereof in this case. But I always found this justification somewhat nonsensical. It's akin to saying that Stalin and Hitler were telling themselves they were committing atrocities to teach humans how not to behave. And I just find it difficult to accept, not only because it feels a little bit cringe-worthy in a narrative sense, but also because I think it lacks coherence. Despots do not cease to exist just because some despots in the past exist. What do you think about that?
For sure. I mean, I think it's a clever idea to have this long run. I think that what I think is right, it's like following the Dune novels are so dramatic, and you don't want to. What Herbert avoids is a trap that many sci-fi fantasy writers do, which is basically to reenact their greatest triumphs. So if you think about like the terrible Star Wars remakes, I mean the modern ones, the Disney Star Wars movies, like every one of them has a Death Star, basically. Because like, oh, the Death Star's in the original Star Wars movie, we have to have a Death Star. So I think a lot of fans of Dune wanted a sequel, well, sequel novels, which were like Dune, which had war between the houses, which had epic battles, which had, like, you know, maybe a new planet. The fans of Dune, I think, wanted a sequel to Dune that was like Dune. And with God Emperor of Dune, Frank Herbert basically says F you to those fans and creates this very strange novel where sometimes nothing, very little happens. And Leto II basically, you know, like he deliberately creates stagnation, and he's very oppressive and autocratic, but he has this kind of justification for it. I agree, it doesn't fully work to my mind. I think it was an interesting exercise because he is a tyrant, and this is like an interesting justification for being a tyrant. It's an interesting state. I think it was an interesting development for the series of novels, but in some sense, I almost think they should have ended there. I think it'd be better if God Emperor of Dune was the last novel. Actually, I don't think we gain a lot from Heretics of Dune or Chapter House Dune, in my view. Unless if Frank Herbert had lived another 20 years, maybe he could have created a more interesting narrative plot around those later novels.
To start wrapping this talk, would you mind expanding a little bit on what you previously said, that Dune was your favorite science fiction novel? Would you like to say why? Why this is the case?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to think. I like other science fiction as well. I think that it combines some of the better things about fantasy, heroic fantasy, like the characters. My view of like a lot of classic age sci-fi, so Philip K. Dick, Asimov era sci-fi, at least to me, I think if I had read those books when I was younger, I might like them more, because when you're a young reader, you can pick up a very threadbare plot and use your imagination to add a lot of extra richness to it. But reading those books as an adult, the characters are too thin sometimes, or there's lack of characterization in classic era kind of sci-fi. Whereas Dune, I think, and this is something I touch in my piece, Dune has this layer of myth. So Paul Atreides is this mythical figure. He kind of has echoes of characters from Greek tragedy, echoes of Hamlet avenging his father. So there's some rich kind of, there's some literary echoes, and there's some kind of fantasy kind of tropes. Avenging your father is a kind of fantasy trope as well. Going on a quest, going into the desert. Which have historical resonances as well. So, you know, Frank Herbert's always layering in these like historical words, like, you know, Arabic words, or, you know, there's a lot of historical resonances in Gene. And so that gives it a richness that, say, Heinemann's Starship Troopers, to me, doesn't have, although that's fun as well. So that's why I think Dune is appealing as a novel to me. I think a lot of people share that. I think what I'm saying is unique to myself. A lot of people like Dune for those reasons. It's not just, it's a combination of a rich universe with cool technologies, kind of surprising and weird social arrangements, and a classic story, which has echoes of mythology and those stories. I like the other science fiction world I like, which is very much a nerdy thing to like. But I like the Warhammer 40,000 scientific universe, which is totally derivative of Gene. And but the advantages and disadvantages of that universe are as follows. One is, it's not the creation of any one person. It's a creation of many people. That's good and bad. It means there's no canonical book like Gene. It means there's like 300 books. But of those 300 books, some are really good. Some are terrible. But there's more freedom for people to kind of do their own thing and pick up characters and enrich the world more. So actually, that's a fantasy universe, sci-fi universe I like the most. But it's totally derivative of things like Gene. Actually, you know, there's a god emperor. He's been on the throne for 10,000 years. There's elite military orders. There's some kind of quasi feudal elements to it. So that's a very much derivative sci-fi world, but it's also a very rich one. But Dune is my favorite standalone sci-fi novel by a long way, I think.
And being into the most recent works, I don't know if you have read this much hype work, The Three-Body Problem. And it has recently been adapted by Netflix. I haven't seen the TV series, but it touches upon other sci-fi themes like First Contact, the Fermi Paradox, and social issues about basically what do we do as a human species if they contact us. So,
Three-Body Problem is an amazing book. Yeah, I actually, it's my shame, I've only read the first one. I've not read the whole trilogy. I thought it was an amazing book. I think it's some of the characterization and like characters on a thinner side, and you have to kind of they die off, so you kind of you abandon them. But as a, it does an amazingly good job of. I love the beginning of a book, actually, because it interweaves this Cold War, you know, Chinese Communist Party era kind of world with our modern day, and with the possibility of future contact from a more advanced alien species. So I think it's great. I've heard that the recent Netflix series is not great. People were blown away by like the first couple of scenes, but they're saying some of the plot and characterizations are not as compelling. But I think it you know, it was dying to be adapted. We'll see how good a job they do.
Well, to end, do you have any other personal recommendations for books, movies, or works of science fiction that you would like to recommend?
Well, I've given you my Warhammer 40,000 ones, Horus Heresy novels. Beyond that, I have to look this up actually because I get the titles wrong. There's another series. I can't pronounce this guy's name either. Just let me. Well, these are not as sophisticated as Dune, and the Mars Rising novels are quite fun if you like space opera, violent space opera set in a near future world with some of the similar themes of Dune, like houses and violence. Although it's a little, the first novel in particular has a bit of a young adult flavor to it. It's not as sophisticated as some other science fiction. The one I was thinking about, which I thought was quite good, is Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. That's about you know, evolution, religion, God, all those themes. Again, I think I class that as more hard sci-fi. Like, I think the ideas are really good in it. It's about spiders, if you don't know. It's about a colony of spiders who develop human-like characteristics or intelligence. That's a very, very good novel for the development of the ideas. It's not as great when it comes to characterization or or plot, in my view. But yeah, the ideas drive the novel.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Professor Mark, and it was nice to have you.
Great. Thanks, Fernando. It's been fun.
Quality science fiction prompts us to contemplate potential future scenarios arising from emerging technological constraints. Dune played a pivotal role in popularizing the genre by drawing inspiration from events of the 20th century. In doing so, it reshaped social's perception of what to anticipate in the 21st and future centuries to come.
From the Penn Initiative for the Study of Markets at the University of Pennsylvania's Economics Department. Our goal is to bring a thoughtful, fact-based, and entertaining discussion on the historical experience of markets and their philosophical foundations. I am Fernando Arteaga, and I will be glad to hear from you. You can follow us on Instagram and on Twitter as @Penn_Exchange. Stay tuned.